This is All In. I'm Jill Sheridan. Today we're talking about an increase in violent crime that many cities experienced in 2020. Indianapolis follows this trend and just recorded the deadliest year, 245 homicides. Other Indiana cities and communities have also seen a rise in homicides. This does follow some reporting that I recently did on this topic, a series called Root Causes. It can be found at WFYI.org. If you have questions or comments on our show today, please let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail. Call 866-476-3881. Just give us your name, where you're calling from, and a quick question or comment. We'll do our best to get it into the conversation. Again, that's 866-476-3881. You can also send us a high-quality voice message with our smartphone app called All In Vox Pop. It's free and easy to use. Just search for All In Vox Pop on your phone's app store. We're now joined by Darius Ross, who is the founder of the Ross Foundation, an Indianapolis nonprofit grassroots group that works to address some of these issues. Thank you. Thank you so much, Darius, for joining us today. I know it's a busy day for you.
Hello. Hey, how you doing?
I'm okay. I'm good, and I hope that you'll be doing better real soon. But can you give us a little bit of background about your organization, the Ross Foundation? How you got started, and you know what your goal was really when you did get started?
Yeah. My name is out of Indianapolis, and I grew up off of 42nd and Post Road. So if you know about that area, it has the biggest food desert in the Midwest. Currently, has the highest eviction rate in the entire state. It has the poorest reading literacy rate in the entire state. It has the highest population of felons in the entire state in this area, but no limited resources and services. And we have a lot of low income residents on this side of town, where we have 40 apartment complexes back to back. That is Section 8. Or low income, and they don't have nearly enough resources and services to thrive. And so I wanted to create a grassroots nonprofit organization to bridge that gap. I used to be in the streets. I used to be a leader of a gang on 42nd and Post and changed my whole life around. I lost 45 friends to gun violence. Wow. And I wanted to be the change I wanted to see in my community. I wanted to break that cycle of generational trauma and generational poverty. And so my organization mission is to take the community out of survival mode into thriving mode through creating effective youth programs, repairing our communities, and developing leaders. Our vision is to bridge the gap between services, resources, and wellness programs coming into communities in need. And we operate around our five pillars, youth empowerment, advocacy, crime prevention, community wellness, and emergency response, which we added due to COVID-19.
Yeah. A lot of people need that, you know, those basic needs right now filled. We've seen that go up so much, and your organization filling those gaps is a really important part of it. You touched on this a bit. You know, the higher rates that we see on the far east side of Indianapolis, so much of it linked to the systemic inequality that we experience in a city like Indianapolis. It's difficult, everything that you're trying to reach. What do you see as the main difficulties as we're looking at this enormous problem?
Yeah, I mean, support. Making sure that we are addressing the root causes. And the only people really addressing the root causes is grassroots organizations. They are the closest to the pain. And we are usually overlooked. We usually don't have enough funding, resources, or services to connect to the people who's directly in need. And we're the only ones boots on the ground, going, meeting people where they are. You know, we're talking about people who may not have access to internet, Wi-Fi, transportation, disabilities, and maybe just have so many disparities and barriers that are keeping them from thriving. Who's reaching those populations? And usually traditional organizations are not. And so we have to start looking outside of the box of just supporting traditional organizations and supporting non-traditional organizations especially in the midst of a pandemic, we are the only ones who could get food, essential items, to the people who's in need in our community.
Yeah, if you talk about, you know, the grassroots work, and it's really the knowing who is in need and being able to reach them when other avenues might not be able to do that. And a group like yours is able to identify people more quickly. It's kind of the thought, yeah, right?
Yeah, because we thrive on building relationships and connecting to people. We don't want to just provide a service and leave. That's called the Band-Aid effect. That's what I call it. And we want to heal the wound. We don't want to provide a temporary resource and they come back the next month needing the same resource. No, we want to actually address the root causes so they won't need to need this resource or service again. And so that's how you actually start to change the community long term. When you focus on the root causes of why people have to sell drugs, why people have to kill each other, why people are homeless, why people do not have access to jobs or transportation, why people are being discriminated against, and so many different things. And living in poor housing conditions, when you address the root causes, the foundational things, then you will start to see the violence in our communities go down, the mental health and our trauma in our communities go down. And so it's time to put our communities back into thriving mode and take them out of survival mode, because when you put them in survival mode, you know, when you take away all the resources and services out of a community, what do you expect to happen when they have to survive? They got to do what they got to do to survive, and they don't have anything to thrive.
Housing, you mentioned, is one of the issues that I know you've been working so closely on, you know, even pre-pandemic, with Indiana having some of the highest eviction rates in the whole country. What is some of the work that you're doing right now? You know, safe, affordable housing is really one of those roots that has to be addressed.
Yeah. If you don't know, we are the first tenants' rights union in the entire state of Indiana. It's called the Indianapolis Tenants Rights Union. And we have hired tenant advocates to go door to door to do check-ins to see if they need help or assistance in housing. They may not have access to information on eviction moratoriums. They may be taken advantage of by their landlords, or they may not know how to fill out the application for rental assistance or utility assistance. Or they may need a sample letter to write to their landlord or judge or property manager, and we assist them with that and walk them through the process, and we follow up with them to make sure that they don't need anything else. We don't leave them hanging. We're making sure that they are in a safe, livable, inhabitable housing condition. And even pre-COVID, we were number two behind New York City in evictions filed. And we're not nearly the population, so you know it's more than people just not making rent going on in Indiana. It's a combination of discrimination, retaliation, and living in deplorable living conditions. And we are one of the few states that still allows as a law that still states that you cannot withhold rent, even if you're living in inhabitable living conditions. And a lot of people typically who's uninformed about this law usually try to hold their rent when they're living in mold, when they're living in feces, when their ceiling is caved in, and you can see the pipes. And when you look up, and every time it rains, the water comes down their ceiling, down their walls, leaving more mold, leaving mushrooms to grow on their doors, on their walls. This is unsafe for any household. Any children, it's not right, and it is unjust to let any children have to breathe in this mold and have it in their system, and then they develop a mental illness or disability because of it.
Mm-hmm. I know that your group has been able to work more with other groups, even reaching past Indianapolis and the Far East Side, trying to you know, fill these needs. What sort of successes have you seen?
Yes, we have joined. We are also part of the Hoosier Housing Needs Coalition, which is steered by Prosperity Indiana. We have advocated for vetoes, for the governor to veto legislation around housing. We have fought and sat down with so many different legislators throughout this pandemic. We have advocated for tenant rights to make sure that it is implemented across the state and that landlords are abiding by these rights and laws. Because if they're doing what they're supposed to do in the first place, they shouldn't be pushing back about tenant rights. I mean, they know their rights. Why can't the tenants know their rights? And so we've been doing a lot of big advocacy work statewide. We have created tenant unions across the state. We're continuing to create more tenant unions. And so if anyone's interested in their area, their county, across the state, opening up a tenants union, they could reach out to us at the Ross Foundation. And we will definitely get them involved and start the process, because what we're doing is it takes the whole entire state to change legislation, and we have to get organized in order to create effective change that affects the root causes. We have to change laws and legislation.
And so this show is going, you know, statewide to many different communities. That's good to hear that this work is reaching out and that you're accomplishing that.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much for taking some time today. This is Dee Ross. He's founder of the Ross Foundation. I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jill. You have a great day.
You too. We will be back after a quick break. We're talking today live about the so-called root causes of violent crime that disproportionately impact low-income Black residents in Indiana. If you have questions or comments for the show, please let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I am Jill Sheridan. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Jill Sheridan. Today we're discussing the root causes of violent crime in communities, one of the many ways the pandemic disproportionately impacts low-income and Black residents in Indiana. We would love your questions and comments on the topic. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from, at 866-476-3881. You can also send us a voice message through our free smartphone app called All In Vox Pop. Just search for All In Vox Pop on your phone's app store. Send us your question or comment, and we will try to get on to the show. We're joined now by two guests who have studied this issue. Unai Miguel Andres is a data analyst at the IU PUI Polis Center with SAVI, and Kelsey Stringham Markowitz is a research coordinator with the IU Public Policy Institute, the Center for Research on Inclusion and Social Policy, or CRISP. Welcome to you both.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, Unai, I'd love to start with you today, maybe just broadly for someone who hasn't heard of the Polis Center here in Indianapolis and SAVI. Where is your research really focused these days, and what do you do?
As Jill said, I'm Unai Miguel Andres. I'm a data analyst at the Polis Center at IUPUI. We are a research center that focus on communities, on providing data and help communities to be resilient. And we do a lot of different things, one of which is putting a wonderful tool set or system, which is the SAVI Community Information System, which is a free community information system that allows people to see data about their communities within Central Indiana. We also provide data literacy training programs to help organizations and individuals to better understand issues going in their communities. And we also put research out about different topics, one of which it's insecurity and violence within the community.
Just such a wealth of information for anyone that hasn't checked it out. Please do. Kelsey, maybe you could tell us a little bit about the IU Public Policy Institute and the Center for Research on Inclusion and Social Policy as well, two fairly new systems here in Indiana.
Sure. The IU Public Policy Institute has actually been around for a while. It's affiliated with both the IUPUI and the IU Bloomington campuses. But the Center for Research on Inclusion and Social Policy is relatively new. We sort of officially became a thing in 2018. And our focus is really on specifically looking at social policy, issues of equity, and how that affects our local communities.
So both of the groups obviously doing some of this work in the same ways and really taking a look at these issues broadly. Kelsey, I might ask you then, you know, as you start to delve into this research and really look at equity in communities, because that's what we're talking about. You know, I started looking at this issue when we were looking at some work that we did a number of years ago when it was sort of a novel idea here in the public policy and the public safety realm to focus on areas that have historically experienced social disadvantage and as it relates to crime. You know, when we're looking at equity and its relationship to certain communities, what do we see in a city like Indianapolis?
Sure. We look at a lot of different areas. We look at a lot of different sort of measures of social policy. Mm. So we look at housing, we look at crime. Within the IU Public Policy Institute, there's also the Center for Health and Justice Research. We partner with them, looking at issues of reentry and substance abuse. You know, we're looking at mental health stuff, and across all these areas, you know, we can see a disparity in the ways that Black and Brown communities in Indianapolis experience these things is quite different than majority white communities. And so as a thread throughout all of our work, we're always looking at that racial equity piece, but also issues around gender equity, disability, immigration status, things like that, as a lens through which to understand kind of the different experiences that different groups in the community have and what the implications of that might be.
And those different experiences certainly play out when you look at violent crime in Indianapolis this year, recording 245 homicides compared to the record, which previously was set in 2017 at 179. Indianapolis, not alone, a lot of other large metropolitans are reporting this for 2020. Fort Wayne also seeing an uptake. I know that Lake County and LaPorte County also seeing, you know, increased homicide rates. Strangely, some of the other crime indicators have gone down, but you know, this is something that we've been dealing with for a long time, but certainly has worsened during the pandemic. Unai, do you have any thoughts? Just you know, as we take a look back at this year, and I know Savvy did some work, just sort of trying to distill those social factors, you know, what we might have seen happen in 2020?
Well, as we all know, this pandemic has had huge social and economic impacts within communities and individuals living on them. A lot of people have lost their jobs. Several thousands of individuals within the Indianapolis area got their hours reduced. Mm-hmm. Which then led them to being unable to pay for their rents, for their utilities, being able to buy food. And that's stressful, right? And a lot of these individuals might come from families that were already really stressed out, what people refer to as working poor. Mm-hmm. So those individuals that were working full-time, but they barely were able to meet their need. And now they experience their hours cut. Dad lost their job. Mom has her hours cut in half. And they have 2-3 kids to feed. Well, you can imagine what happens, right? If your kid is hungry, you're going to make whatever is possible to feed them. And as Rose was telling before, a lot of these communities organizations have experienced a huge decline in donations, and they are overworked and stressed and stretched thin out for how to provide the resources they have, with more people being in need. So now you go to the food pantry that you used to go, and they don't have food. Or you go to the community center, or the trustee office that used to assist you to pay your rent bills or your utilities, and they're like, we're out of money. What are you going to do? You're going to try to find that money some other way. And that's when you might attempt robbery, or you might try to get some food, petty thieves. And when things go south, things get really, really bad.
Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, a lack of food isn't going to directly cause, you know, violent crime. But the relationship, I think, is something that we need to take a closer look at when we are, you know, trying to close some of these gaps historically that we've seen in our society, if we have an interest to do that.
Yes, definitely. And there's more and more research that are being done out there that are starting to see a correlation between areas where people are in high poverty or concentrated poverty and areas where lack to us to food is bad, and the number of crimes that are being committed compared to other areas of the city.
And you've done some of that work. I mean, certainly the Polis Center has really looked at, you know, some certain neighborhoods in the city and how that disparity plays out. It's like you mentioned, is the data pretty clear?
It is pretty clear. And sadly, it's such a systemic issue right now, led by years and years of disinvestment and lack of access to good jobs, that it's really hard to figure out how things are going to be solved in the future.
You know, when we were talking about food and we were talking about, you know, some of the programs that have tried to address this issue and public and private programs, I know we talked a lot about a program that I focused on, which was the Gleaners Care Program, which, you know, we've seen so many food distributions have to change their models during the pandemic. How do you see that, you know, programs like this have really stepped up, though?
Oh, yeah, they definitely have. Multiple organizations within the greater Indianapolis area have a step up to the challenge to provide food specifically to people in need. So not only Gleaners, but we also had Second Helping and other organizations providing reliefs. And a lot of centers and multiple nonprofit funders within the community have also helped them to achieve these programs. So while we have seen really a huge decline on purchasing power of individuals and an increment in people with needs, we have also seen an increment in community organizations stepping up. The problem is that now people that might have helped this nonprofit via volunteering or via funding, they have disappeared, or they have become now the people in need.
Mm-hmm. Kelsey, what sort of research are you focused on right now that is sort of, you know, telling us a little bit more or giving us some more depth about the social disinvestment and disparity that we see in many communities?
Sure. We, you know, at CRISP, we're engaged in a lot of different projects all at once. And I love that, that we get to you know, look at many facets of our communities at the same time, because then internally we're able to sort of talk about it and make connections, which is very exciting. But I really want to highlight in this conversation some work we've been doing on the Near East side specifically, when we're combining different types of data to really get an understanding and paint a picture. Now, most of this work that we did was pre-pandemic, but I think it's important to look at that pre-pandemic data to really set the stage, and that can help us make inferences or extrapolate about what may be happening now. Because I think even before the pandemic, one thing that we were really seeing was this interrelation of multiple factors. You know, someone asked me one time, you know, if there's one, you know, root cause of crime, or there's one that's more important than others, like where should we focus our resources and where should we focus our attention? And my response was really that I think that is the question that we as a community have been asking historically, and that has caused us to create these siloed systems and these siloed services, when in reality, it's not that it's an issue of employment or an issue of education or an issue of affordable housing or access to food. It is, in fact, the interrelation of all of those things creating this system where people and communities are experiencing just so many barriers simultaneously. And they're all interrelated. And so I think when it comes to creating solutions, that can be a challenge for us to start to think about how do we address all the things at one time, instead of trying to say, well, I'm going to do a youth program, or I'm going to work on affordable housing. And how can we as a community address the ways in which these factors are interlocking and how they work together or work together against people thriving and even just surviving.
Mm-hmm. I mean, certainly that's the root of the problem. I mean, it's a whole environment that somebody is living in that may, you know, put them at a disadvantage, and so much to reach. And we've dug ourselves into so many holes. We're talking about billions and billions of dollars and reform that needs to be doled out, not to mention, you know, the will to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It's a hefty lift for anyone.
Yeah. Well, and I think then also, you know, the other thing that's important to understand is the will to collaborate and the will for systems that are currently siloed to understand aspects of other systems, right? So, you know, you and I had talked before about, you know, the relationship between substance abuse and mental illness, and how a lot of times with co-occurring disorders, those things go hand in hand, and it can be a bit of a vicious cycle. But then when you situate that within a community that's experiencing underemployment or unemployment and environmental factors and lack of affordable housing and lack of educational opportunities, you know, I think that the systems that we create are very specialized, you know, so we have a system that really addresses homelessness, and we have a system that is focused on youth and education. And there's not always understanding between those systems, or a good concept between, you know, an education focused service or a homeless focused service, and how all of that relates, or an employment focused service, and how does that relate to food insecurity, and how does food insecurity then relate to mental illness and isolation and substance abuse? You know, I think it's that siloing of our services. In addition to the need for more investment, we also need to get out of these silos and start figuring out how do we share information and work collaboratively.
And maybe just first having people even realize, you know, the depth of the problem. As a previous health reporter, I often think of, you know, how we talk about this issue when we talk about health. And it seems to make a little bit more sense to people. I mean, they can grasp that, you know, when we're talking about these same root causes, and when it's social determinants of health, as compared to violence. And maybe Una, I would have you sort of chime in on that, because I know, you know, the Savvy's taken a look at that pretty clearly across neighborhoods as well when we're talking about the social determinants of health. I mean, ultimately, that's what we're talking about anyway, someone's health and well-being.
Yes, definitely. And those that might not be aware, social determinants of health, it's all the factors that affect an individual. So not only them as a person, age, race, ethnicity, income, but also their environment they're in. So the neighborhood, the access of things they have to. So all these social environments and systems join into one person, and then how that determines the effect they have in health. And I think you are exactly on point, Jill, that we should maybe look at this as social determinants of violence or determinants of violence itself. They just don't need to be social. They're social, economical, political as well. And as And as Kelsey was saying, they're all so interrelated. It's like a house of cards. The moment that they're all so sensitive and so precarious that if you take one or one gets folded, the whole card falls and someone is in trouble. And we should, while it's great, and we should still support a lot of these programs at the individual level, because we have become, as a society, really good at some of those programs. There's a need to look at all the factors together and make sure that they work together. So yes, it's fantastic to have housing. But if you don't have a job, that's not going to last.
Right.
Or it's fantastic to have a job, but if you don't have where to go to sleep, or you don't have something as simple now as a utility as a phone, you might lose that job.
Well, we will be back after a quick break with both of you. We are talking about violent crime and the root causes, the social factors that play into it. If you have comments for our guests today, we'd like to chime in, Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. I'm Jill Sheridan. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Jill Sheridan. Back now to our discussion on violence and its root causes. As always, we would love to hear from you with your questions and comments. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or leave us a short voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. Joined now by my guest, Unai Miguel Andres, data analysis with Savvy at the IUPUI Pulla Center, and Kelsey Stringham-Markowitz, research coordinator with the IU Public Policy Institute and the Center for Research on Inclusion and Social Policy. So before the break, Kelsey, we talked a little bit about it, and I'd like to touch on your study that we did talk about when we were exploring the Near East Side and the relationship between mental health and substance abuse and violence. You know, what were some of the findings in that particular study that really struck you?
Yeah, I think, as I was mentioning before, one of the most striking findings was just the level of interrelation of multiple factors, and that you can't just isolate a single factor. You know, and particularly when we really looked at the relationship between substance abuse and mental illness, what we found was this relationship where people were experiencing what's called co-occurring disorders, mm-hmm. which means that they were simultaneously experiencing a mental illness and experiencing a substance use disorder or engaged in using substances. And the relationship between those two things being pretty complex. So someone might have an underlying mental illness, and because of the inaccessibility of mental health care, for some individuals in some communities, you know, we were hearing it's easier to sort of treat those mental health symptoms using illegal substances. And so that is one pathway into, you know, kind of this experience of having a co-occurring disorder. Another way is that, you know, someone might might engage in using substances and as a result trigger a mental illness, or as a result of their environment have a mental illness be triggered while they're using substances. And so when I say environment, I really mean, you know, other traumatic experiences that one can have in a community that's experiencing a lot of barriers. So, you know, having experiences with domestic violence, having experiences with unemployment and housing instability, those are huge stressors that people face. And individuals are experiencing all of these things simultaneously. It makes it very difficult to address a single thing because those experiences are so complex.
And some of the barriers that you cited in the research I found were really interesting. We know we have a provider shortage statewide, you know, when it comes to mental health and substance abuse. Of course, the opioid epidemic might have addressed some of that. But, you know, other barriers that, you know, some of the people that you talked to said, can you talk about some of those?
Sure. You know, I think one of the barriers was around experiences of social isolation, mm-hmm. also like stigma mm-hmm. of receiving mental health care. Those were some that came up. I don't know. Are there ones that you're particularly interested in?
Well, the provider shortage, and also just the idea that, law enforcement may not know where to refer someone to, even though, you know, there are places, or the knowledge piece of it.
Yeah. And I think that also gets back to this idea that I was talking before about around siloed systems. Mm. So frequently, law enforcement will get called when someone's experiencing a mental health crisis or experiencing a crisis related to use of illegal substances. And, an officer might recognize that that's what's going on. But when we interviewed IMPD officers, what we heard is that that's not their area of expertise, and they don't have the resources in that situation to be able to even know where to refer someone or know how to respond, and provide resources in that situation. And so I think that's where, again, you're getting into some siloing of resources and siloing of different ways that we tend to address these issues.
Mm-hmm. Unai, when we talked again about food security, and we know that Indiana has a number of food deserts, and that, that's not just Indianapolis. We deal with food insecurity in many communities across the state in Indiana. What trends do you see when we're seeking to address just that issue in a city like Indianapolis or elsewhere that keep falling short?
Well, so some of the things that we see is that we keep relying in big companies, supermarket, brick and mortar, grocery stores as a method to provide food to individuals, right? To access that you need. Mm-hmm. However, they all are working within a capitalist society, and they want to be where the money is at. And that becomes a major barrier to access healthy food for individuals with lower income or that have disadvantages. However, on the bright side, through the last 4 or 5 years, we have seen a significant increase on the number of grocery stores that are owned by smaller mom and pop owners among minority groups, especially Hispanics and Asian communities throughout the state. So that kind of gives me a little bit of hope that we are starting to move a little bit into the right direction of providing a better access to individuals that might need it, but also improve their economy as well mm-hmm. for those that might be in need of it.
Yeah.
However, for a long time, and still is the case, African Americans and Hispanic individuals have far worse access to healthy food items than white individuals.
Yeah, it's clear. And I mean, like Dee said, I mean, it takes grassroots groups to maybe step up and know what needs to be done in the community and what solutions will work, because it isn't simply about, opening up a brick and mortar grocery store. I mean, there has to be solutions that work in the community.
Oh, definitely. And that's something that it's a problem when we look at food deserts, that we treat them all as all the same, but the individuals are very diverse within the communities. Right? So a lot of people suffering from food insecurity in rural counties are older adults that they're in mobile. So putting a grocery store is not going to help them at all. But there's programs out there and organizations that have stepped up and say, hey, how about we try to bring the food to you instead so you actually can have access to it? Or there are other organizations that I've decided instead of open a brick and mortar, let's bring food through a mobile food market, knowing where people are going to be at mm-hmm. and bring them the items they need in that grocery store that it's moving around. Mm-hmm. Or even empowering people by providing them doubling up their food stamps. So they're not just living in that really small budget, but actually can afford not only nutritious, but high quality items.
Now, you know, the United States is not your native country, but what do you see from the outside looking in when I've talked to one of your colleagues, you know, about the culture of individualism in the United States when it comes to addressing this issue? Do you think that's real?
I do think it's real. People sadly put themselves and their families first. Mm-hmm. However, I'm going to say I have seen more of a change as a result of the pandemic. And I don't want to say the pandemic has been a good thing, but it has made us realize that we are a society and we are a community that depends on each other. So I hope that there might be some change about this individualistic point of view and actually realize that in order for us to succeed as an individuals, the whole community needs to succeed. And that just because we're faring well off doesn't mean that others are. And try to help however we can.
I think, you know, and Kelsey, I'd like maybe you to weigh on it in as well on this. You know, what do you see as some of the real, you know, maybe psychological things that are holding us back when we are trying to address these root issues?
Yeah, I think that's such an interesting question. And, you know, it makes me think of another finding from the same study we were doing on the Near East Side. We asked residents a question about, or a series of questions that measured how socially connected they felt to their neighborhoods. And, you know, we noticed some important disparities in those results that I think really bears a careful examination. You know, so we saw even within the small portion of the Near East Side where we were looking, even within that in individual neighborhoods, there was a variation in the amount of social connectedness within each neighborhood. And I think that that's really something that bears a deeper dive into and more careful examination to really start to understand across Indianapolis, where are those disparities and what are the differences in the ways that people feel community and how they feel connected or disconnected from their neighborhood in particular, but also understanding that someone's community might not be the same as the neighborhood where they live. And how can we start to look at those issues of social connectedness? Because what we found is that that's very much related to these other root causes of crime. It's related to experiences of PTSD and other mental illnesses. It's related to depression and loneliness. And if we can start to understand, you know, how people feel socially connected or not, I think that that's going to be a really important path forward as we try to build community and understand that addressing that issue of social connectedness will have positive effects in all of these other root causes that we were talking about.
You know, it was so interesting this summer when there was so much social unrest and we were hearing from community members that were really weighing in on what they wanted to see. And they wanted, you know, they wanted these small groups to be more supported. They wanted, you know, resources to go to the community, and they wanted, you know, these answers to be on a grassroots level, and they wanted mental health, you know, resources to be improved. The city here in Indianapolis has a mental health response team. It's called MCAT that has been regarded as highly successful. But do you think, you know, that's just one piece of the puzzle? Again, when we're looking at these programs that might be more siloed, you know, what's your take on the community's call just for more of this?
Yeah, I think that is right on, right? Because we do have some of these services, but they're insufficient to meet the need. And additionally, it is one piece of the puzzle. So we talked about how all of these things are interrelated, and you know, the issue of mental health services, that might be the thing that is the most on fire. But truly addressing what it means to truly address mental health at a community level necessarily also means addressing employment and affordable housing and like domestic violence and food insecurity and educational opportunities, right? All of that is also part of mental health.
And you mentioned domestic violence, which some experts are saying, you know, domestic violence deaths increased by more than 80% since pandemic. And, you know, we've seen substance abuse and overdoses rise as well. Are you worried about, you know, where we're headed?
You know, I think some of that is likely related to the isolation that comes with our best public health efforts to stay safe during the pandemic and to stay healthy and well. Mm-hmm. And those things are necessary. And I think, especially for some folks, there has been an experience of increased isolation, which we were already seeing before the pandemic. Mm-hmm. We were already hearing, you know, how detrimental social isolation and lack of social connectedness was in these neighborhoods that were struggling with crime. You know, we were almost already seeing some of that before the pandemic. And then maybe the pandemic has just sort of exacerbated that or made us see that on a broader level and not just in these communities that were experiencing disadvantage already.
And the isolation, certainly, yeah, such a major part of it, and the trauma as well, and the political environment. I don't know if that's helping very much these days either. Unai, I would like to ask you, you know, what strategies do you think that communities should consider to prevent violence by addressing social disparity? Obviously, food is one that you've studied quite a bit, but what are your thoughts?
Well, if I could be an answer, I probably would not be here right now. I would be running for office. But, I wish. No, I think there's not just one solution. There's multiple ones that should be done. First of all, I think related to what Kelsey's saying, like social isolation seems to me a huge part of this. And not only in the feeling of individuals being isolated, but also in how isolated they might also be from resources. The Center for Rural Engagement, in combination with the Sustainable Food Systems at IU, they studied three counties south in on the south of Indiana, and they saw that the number of individuals, seniors, feeling socially isolated had increased like from 20% to almost like 70% pre- and post-pandemic, which is a huge increase. Mm-hmm. And the problem right now is that a lot of the services we're trying to provide are not accessible to individuals. And I'm going to bring this as we are seeing a fantastic work being done by different state agencies and local governments and nonprofits that require you to have access to your computer. Like, you need to chat with someone. They might be able to do a video call with you. Do you need to see a doctor? They're going to do a video call with you. Mm. But what if you do not have it? What if you lack internet or you cannot afford a computer? Where does that leave you, right? So I think one of the things that needs to be done is understand what the needs of their community you're trying to help are and what are the things they have access to.
Really yeah. Seeing from everyone's perspective. Well, I do want to thank you. Thank you both for taking the time today. D. Ross, earlier we spoke with from the Ross Foundation, Unai Miguel Andres, Data Analysis with Savvy and the IU PUI Polis Center, and Kelsey Stringham Markowitz, Research Coordinator with the IU Public Policy Institute, the Center for Research on Inclusion and Social Policy. Thank you both.
Thank you, Jill.
Thank you.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and comprised our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere that you get your podcasts. Join us tomorrow when we talk to a journalist, Josh Baker, who spent the last 4 years digging into the story of a woman from Indiana who found herself involved with ISIS. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Jill Sheridan. Thanks for listening. This is All In.